the cost of ransom, of paying a ransom, has dropped in a year from $150,000 to $105,000. What does that tell us?
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast. So good to be with you guys as usual. We should be going live right as RSA 2025 is kicking off. That's exciting. We're all going to be in town. For Mario, that's not a big deal because you're local and all that. But tell me what you're looking forward to for the week. Mario, are you going to be involved or are you going to stay clammed up in the house?
Oh, no. As probably many of you have, back-to-back meetings. I work for Ambit, and we have rented a hotel in the Hyatt Regency, and Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and I think even Thursday, we have back-to-back meetings where we do 30 minutes with clients, prospects, advisors, et cetera. And so it's going to be super busy.
That's going to be rewarding but exhausting. You're going to definitely need to take time away to ride your bike. So we're going to have a bike ride, right? We're going to start a Golden Gate Alpine Dam loop, 5:30 a.m. on Tuesday. We have a handful of cyber-related cyclists. Ping me if you want in. Mario will be there signing autographs.
I will be there just because it's you, Jerry, and you're coming across the country.
Right. Where can people find you? Do you have any of your schedule, something that's good for dropping in or anything like that, or... You just have to be on the bike ride.
It's probably the bike ride is going to be the safest. I think just like all of you, you know, our mornings are booked, afternoons are booked, and then the dinners are for the VCs or the bigger companies hosting some sort of party. So hopefully we get to share some drinks during the evening. Yeah, and we do have a booth in the main floor this time around, which is cool. We've matriculated to the main floor.
Wow.
Yeah,
right, yeah. Growing up.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Well, since we're talking only about cycling, no, that's just me. Wednesday morning is the more inclusive 6 a.m. 20-mile ride. Sunil's done it before, right?
We did 20 miles?
Maybe we did 15, 20. Oh, I don't know, but wow. You were out there hoofing it. Good job. Up Hawk Hill, all that.
Yeah.
Are you going to get any exercise this time?
I think, well, usually I put in something close to 30,000 steps per day when I'm at RSA.
Wow.
Which itself is exhausting, right? But fortunately, my team's been able to secure Fang, the restaurant where I'll have most of my meetings. So it's almost the exact opposite. Instead of losing, instead of burning calories, I'll just basically be accumulating calories while eating some of the great food that Kathy Fang has at her restaurant. So anyway, yeah, that's where to find me most of the time.
Awesome. Like the official restaurant of the cybersecurity community. Forget about RSA.
That's right. Yeah, it's a great setup because she has this second floor that's quiet that you can actually have meetings and such. And so and it's super close to Moscone. So, you know, location.
Totally. Okay. Awesome. Well, I already spilled that I'm going to be doing some cycling. Otherwise, I'll be floating around doing a lot of one-on-ones, that sort of thing. Dropping in a few things. I am hosting, so my startup, Adversarial Risk Management, we are hosting a happy hour demo at 5 p.m. on Tuesday, adversarial.com/RSAC, and gonna like bring everybody up to speed on what we've been up to and have a little fun and then hit the hit all the other events after that and before that. Yeah. So see me there. I hope, like Mario said, I hope the three of us can get together in one spot at one point as well.
Yeah, we're going to do a selfie at least.
Oh, yeah, exactly, an obligatory selfie. Beyond that, look, there's going to be a bunch of AI. I think that'll be pretty hot as usual this year. I think there'll be a lot of talk about politics and Chris Krebs and some of the things that we talked about. I think that'll be inevitable. I saw a panel with there's an event with him and Jen Easterly. And Alex Stamos.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, enjoy. A lot of popcorn being popped in San Francisco right now. Any other stuff that you guys are on the lookout for or expect out of the conference this year?
So there's some couple events that I have might, you know, folks want to check it out. So it's, the Innovation Sandbox is on Monday. I think it kicks off around 9 o'clock. And and for those who don't know, my company has the privilege of being one of the 10 that will present. And so I don't know exactly what time, but it'll be sometime between 9 o'clock and I think 11 or so.
You're talking about AM, obviously, 9 a.m.
9 a.m. Yes, Pacific time. And there's a group called the Professional Association of CISOs that is launching a big conference on Wednesday, and I don't have the specific registration information, but we can put that in links or something like that, so I suppose. But anyway, I'm doing a workshop on what the future of cybersecurity work looks like in the age of AI. And then I have my annual Cyber Defense Matrix workshop as a part of the RSA conference itself on Thursday morning at 8 o'clock. So this is where we get about 100 people. We usually fill up the room with 100 people who have a chance to just go through and do an exercise, use the Cyber Defense Matrix, and walk through a couple exercises that I've come up with and a couple other people have come up with so that they can put it to practice.
Awesome. Well, best of luck.
And then a book signing. Sorry, one more thing. Sorry, jeez. And a book signing at 11 o'clock p.m. a.m. on Thursday as well at the bookstore.
Yeah, so you named maybe three or four things, but that's out of probably 30 that you're doing. So.
Oh, and then, sorry, one more
thing. Go. Let's do it.
There's also a pitch for charity. So the Security Tinkerers is doing a pitch for charity at 3 o'clock on Wednesday. And this one's cool because Chris Castaldo, and it's at the Okta headquarters, which is on 101st Street. But anyway, he was able to get $100,000 of sponsorship / support that will be donated to charity. It's a veterans group, I think, that he has. But that's a really cool event, too. My company Gnostic is privileged to be able to present at that as well, but that's another cool event that folks should be aware of.
So that sounds great, man. It's going to be nuts, but hey, best of luck to everybody on all the stuff that you're pursuing. But you know, Sunil, you and Gotti in particular on the Innovation Sandbox. I mean, I think it was a massive reward just to be in the top 10. But now you're playing the boiler room here, and it's going to be fun. And I hope you guys can bring home the gold.
I'm going to put my money on not just because we know Sunil, he's a stellar guy, but I'm going to put my money on Gnostic AI, and I've already put my money on it, but I'm going to put my money on them winning it. I'm going to do a little unfair pitch for Gnostic AI because I know we're not supposed to be talking about each other's products, but at least I can speak to Gnostic about Gnostic, and there isn't a conversation that I don't have with people, CISOs and security people about, you know, the problem that Gnostic is solving, and where I am just smiling and says, go call Sunil or go look at Gnostic AI, because they really are solving a problem in the most elegant way, a really difficult problem. So kudos to you, Sunil. Really excited.
Thanks. And it's, thank you very much for that. There's some interesting challenges that emerge when you're presenting at the Innovation Sandbox because, one, you have this incredibly compressed time. You have to present everything in 3 minutes. And when I presented last year at Black Hat, I had 5 minutes. 5 minutes is short. 3 minutes is even, the amount of intensity of 3 minutes is incredible. And so the notion of less is more really does apply, and the ability to truly condense your message down to like the core of what you really want to say, honing it down is just an incredible amount of work. And it seems so simple, yet it is incredibly challenging. So that's one thing that we've learned.
And is it both of you or just one of you?
Oh, it's just one of me. Yeah, one of us. And it's going to be Gotti who's going to go up and fill
the pressure. Gotti's doing it. Oh.
Yeah. And the other interesting challenge, and this may be representative of what we'll see at RSA writ large, but I think four of the sandbox companies are basically AI companies. And so we should expect to see not just a little of AI, we should expect to see a lot of AI, whether it's in the products that are being, you know, hawked at, or just the topics that will come up as well. I can't imagine it won't be pervasive across many of the conversations and the pitches.
Oh, you're totally right. Yeah, the only reason I downplayed it is I felt like if I said it, it would sound like I was rolling my eyes about all the damn AI, and then I knew you were in an AI startup, so I was like, oh, that'd be awkward. But yeah, I agree, it's going to be everywhere.
And this is why I think, just to finish up maybe what Mario was kind of saying, I'll give a hint as to, for those who don't know what we're doing, I think what we're doing is something more fundamental than AI itself, and more fundamental to security itself, which is, how do we capture need to know? How do we understand need to know in a systematic way? And this is not just an AI problem. This is a security problem. But its applicability to AI is so foundational. It's amazing that we haven't really tackled it already. But anyway, it's something that I think helpfully will differentiate us enough.
You know, Jerry and Sunil, this is, I'm usually pretty jaded. I've been going to RSA since 99. 98, 99, yeah. So, and I've grown jaded, right, through the decades. Oh, it's the same thing. Oh, what is this? Oh, nothing good, nothing new. This is actually the first time where I'm really excited to see what the AI solutions are out there, because I think it's this thing with AI, and as much as I've dragged my feet, it's actually real. I've seen it now. I've seen how productive it can be and helpful. And it's changing. It's changing how we work. But we security people, I feel, are not ready to tackle this AI new world. And so I'm looking forward to learning from a lot of vendors next week.
So on that front, one other perspective that I think we should have when it comes to vendors is I've started to say it this way, which is open source software allowed us to go from zero to one when it comes to software. AI is enabling us to go from zero to one when it comes to building companies. Okay. And so we should see lots more companies emerge. But here's the thing. Zero to one has now become easier, but one to N is still hard. And building software that is that can scale, that can be truly functional, enterprise ready, you know, scalable, whatever, that's hard work. That requires real security engineering, and vibe coding is not going to get you there. Okay, in the same way, AI is again helping us go from zero to one for companies, and so we should expect to see so many more companies over the next couple months to years. But what's really going to be able to set them apart is those companies that can go from a course one to N and scale, and to be able to do it in a way that can really meet the needs of various types of enterprises. And to do that, it does require like real talent, real money. There's AI is not going to be the, in my view, AI is not going to really set those companies apart from the ones who just go from, there's going to be tons of companies that go from zero to one, but the ones that go from one to N are the ones that are going to be based on real talent and a big war chest.
Yeah. You know, to speak to your point, Mario, about you know, what we're going to hear about this week, did you guys track, there is apparently, I don't think we talked about this on the last episode, it must have been since then, but I hadn't pulled it out. I guess there was some like quasi-deterministic fictitious repo or set of repos that a lot of Copilot code gens would point to. They would say, you know, and pull this package, it doesn't exist. And so someone went out and registered all those fake packages and put malware on them. So, I mean, this is a little bit of a little micro plague over the last couple of weeks. A lot of things were bundling in some malware because someone had the foresight to know what the hallucinations were going to be.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like I think what they call slop, AI slop or something like that.
Yeah, slop squatting or...
Yeah, slop squatting, that's it, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Nuts. Great segue, right? Verizon Data Breach Investigation Report just came out. No coincidence, I bet, that it's right before RSA. And here we are talking about a little bit. Likewise, I think slop squatting came out a little bit too late, so it didn't quite make the cut. But this is a massive report. It's been around for a few years. I would generally say very well regarded. You know, there's always bits in there. Everybody loves bits in there that everybody hates. There's contentious bits, but it's like this podcast. You know, it sets up the topics and all of that. I know I started to go through it. I haven't completely crushed it, that's for sure. I had a few thoughts about it as I went through. If you guys got a chance to go through it, did you have any, like, do you see any thematic changes this year? And not just about what the content of the report, but also the style and the approach or anything like that that you think is very different?
Well, one thing that hasn't changed, which I really, really appreciate, is just that the team of writers is basically giving the middle finger to the lawyers, the Verizon lawyers, and writing what they feel, what they think, and thus the footnotes are always fantastic to read. In fact, I usually actually just read the footnotes first, then I go back and figure out what was in the report. So, for those who have never read the footnotes, if the only thing that you read in the DBI are the footnotes, you'll leave a better person.
Yeah. Well, you know, some of the stuff that I really appreciate about it was, like, for one, they went ahead and defined the incident and breach, right?
Yep.
And I don't think that it's like, now we know what it really means in the world. They define what it means for the sake of the report, which is all anyone can do, right? And so I'm not going to say they're putting it to bed, but I think we talked about it on this. They're saying breach is data and that a breach is a subset of an incident and that something like DDoS is not a breach. In theory, manipulation of data without actually retrieving it would not be a breach. I like that. I'm probably going to just work with that. It was only defined for the sake of the DBIR of the report, but we need some vocabulary in this industry sometimes. So that was pretty good. That said, that made the astute reader able to realize that a lot of the metrics that you're looking at were just for breaches, which means, you know, ransomware without data, blackmail is not in that data set, and sabotage attacks are not in that data set. So you have to really think hard. And this report's pretty deep already, but to not just jump to false conclusions, you got to pay attention to the writing because they're clear if you look.
If I recall, though, I think the Verisk framework does include things like sabotage. You know, so things are not, strictly speaking, a data breach. So the whole Volt Typhoon and the compromise of the telecom providers, it wasn't so much a data breach as it is just, you know, positioning or pre-positioning, and all that stuff is very much a major incident. Maybe it's not a breach, but it's still, you know, significant enough that one should count it in the. It's definitely above just a. You know, an incident, and like,
well,
so maybe there's another word that we need to use. If
no,
not
no, I hang on. So, I mean, I think you're implicit in that is what you're kind of messaging is that breach is a really big deal, and mm-hmm. that there are things that are not breached that are still a really big deal. Mm-hmm. I don't see breach as like the tip of the pyramid, and you have incidents and breach, it's the ultimate. To me, breach is data,
yeah,
and that's definitely not the ultimate. And then there's like sabotage, like. Ukraine black energy, right? Not a data breach. Massive. More than all this stupid data. I mean, the Equifax breach, nothing burger. Whoa, who said that? Yeah, come on, let's be honest. Compare that to the Hezbollah pagers, right? Like, we're all getting wound up about social security numbers. Doesn't really matter. So I don't think breach is the top of the iceberg. I just think it's one of a few facets here.
It's one of the facets. It is. It's one of the facets. I agree with you, Jerry. I read, you know, as many of us have probably done, is read, you know, every year this report that's come out from Verizon, or since they've been publishing it. This was by far my favorite. It was, I thought, you know, even what we're just talking about, defining a security incident and a data breach, even spending and sharing time to actually try to make some sense. I mean, maybe not of the overall industry, but at least talking about the report and saying, here's how we think of this. And I applaud them for that. I applaud them for continuing to try to use statistics as much as possible, even when there's a lot of noise. And they'll even say that. They'll even admit there. That there are times there's a lot of noise and that we're not looking at complete data sets at times. So I really enjoyed it. I thought what I learned about it, I felt that had been happening already for this past year, but now they've kind of put their stamp of approval on that. What all of us have been noticing, credentials, you know, it's weird, but credentials are still there. And they're even bigger in this whole, you know, CICD space, which we've talked about in our podcast multiple times, how some of these credentials, API, tokens are accidentally stored or intentionally stored by the employee, and they get exposed. And then they're off to the races when an attacker gains access to them. So I really appreciate that they highlighted that area.
The credential bit,
Yeah.
And you know, that's a good example, though, of what I was talking about, in that some of the statistical data, like there's one that says 22% of things involved credential abuse, whereas 20% involved exploitation of vulnerabilities and 16% phishing.
Yeah.
The things in that case were breaches. So I mean, they're not doing anything wrong here, but I'm just saying that means credential abuse is related in data theft. So the classic, I'll pick on China for it because I think they're the most a notorious actor when it comes to data theft writ large. And so it's saying they're really into credential abuse there. But it's important to note, because if your focus is more on the Black Energy attack or on your solar winds and you're delivering software and you're worried about like a reverse supply chain, someone compromising the code you're going to deliver to customers, those aren't data breaches, right? Those are different things. So you can't just look at that data breach report and use that to guide your efforts. I also think like one of the reason why I'm glad they defined some taxonomy is because otherwise it's very confusing. At the same time, they do something that we're all guilty of, which is to use non-parallel constructs sometimes. Like the first visual that comes out of the report, it may be the cover, maybe, it has this very cool visualization from an infographic standpoint, the way that they did it. And it talks about five different categories, and it lets you relatively see how often they were used in 2024 versus 2023 versus 2024. And they are system intrusion, miscellaneous errors, social engineering, basic web application attacks, privilege misuse. It doesn't take me long at all. I can't figure out anything, any incident that only is one of those. So I struggle with that. Because if you socially engineer me to get my admin password and log in, now we have a system intrusion, right? I mean, and privilege misuse, you just did that too, because now you're using my admin privilege. Like, these aren't mutually exclusive categories. And that always stresses me out.
Well, this is a, you have to chalk that up to the Veris framework, which I think they actually mentioned in the report that it's the 20th anniversary of the 15th anniversary of Veris framework. So I think I've had lots of conversations actually with Hutton and Wade and I don't know, Chris, I mean Chris was part of it too, but of creating this too, but I haven't had as many conversations with him about it. But I've had many long conversations about like what's the right taxonomy for this, for how do you organize all this, and it's hard, right?
Yeah.
It's they did the best they could, and it's still wrong. But I don't know if it'll ever be right for anything that we ever come up with. But it was a workable model that allowed some sort of understanding of how to organize these things so that we can start making decisions on what areas we should focus on first. And I think that's maybe the point here. Yes, some of these are chained sort of things. But if the first point of entry is social engineering versus a direct, web application attack onto a system, let's at least know that that's the first point of entry, the beachhead that people use, and we'll use that. And that allows us to focus our energy and efforts on the things that can thwart those first beachheads the best.
My favorite line was where they say, and I mentioned this to you guys earlier, is that if you are an AI agent being used to summarize this report, they basically say, don't. This is actually written by people and should be consumed by humans, not AI agents. Which, by the way, anybody who listens to our show, please do look at it. It's actually in the footnotes that Sunil mentions as well. There's just so much information here that we can learn from. I applaud these guys. They did a really, I'm actually really excited about this report. It was good.
And the report is also very visual too, for those who've never read it. So having an AI, having an LLM summarize it, you lose a lot of the what was Kelly? Well, Kelly Shortridge once said, it looks like a canary like vomited over, or some unicorn or canary vomited over the page. And that was one of the, like 3 or 4 years ago that they had this new visualization. But the visualizations are really fascinating too. So having an LLM do it, it doesn't serve it justice.
Yeah. Well, so there's some content in there, a lot of content in there that certainly reflects on some of the things we've talked about in the podcast. And in sometimes it kind of supports what we said. Other times it's, oh, you could tell that the window closed for the data collection X months ago and something new happened. And other times it kind of makes us realize, oh, we were wrong, and they have a big data set and they proved it. One thing I noticed, and again, this is such a detailed report. There was one that said 46% of compromised systems that had corporate logins were unmanaged and hosting both personal and business credentials. Yeah. Like, that is, for one, it's massive BYOD. We talked about that last episode. People are logging into your stuff from BYOD. Don't stop short if you feel like it's okay. We trust them because their box is going to get compromised. But the other thing, and I didn't see at least in that little snippet, was browser sync, right? And you log into your personal browser at work, let it store all your credentials, then log back in at home, and it syncs it over through the Google Cloud or whatever it may be. That's got to be a contributor as well. This is a serious situation. The BYOD sprawl that came with, I think, with remote work initially, and then with internet based IDPs and so on. So other things that I saw in here, I thought this was really interesting. Phish testing. Generally, people hate phish testing these days. I still believe there's a chance for it, but I haven't seen it done super well yet. But I think it can be done well. But the thing I do hate about phish testing is that people are almost always penalized or scored as failing if they click a link. I click the link, aha, this was a trap, you failed, go, you know, start preparing your apology right now.
Hate it, right? They didn't just click, they didn't even select anything more than that.
That's it.
Yeah, that was it. Yes, ding.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And like my conclusion in looking at select human element component enumerations in breaches, and what they actually did, the number one was credential abuse. One-click hacks, for most intents and purposes, don't exist. Like, most people out there don't need to be worried about one-click attacks. And when that happens, no one wants to burn that on the masses. And you know that you're protecting a high-value target. It's a different story. So there's no way you can penalize someone for clicking the thing. You've got to bring them to a form and have them put stuff in, or download a thing, or allow something to run. Like, you have to do that because that's the actual transgression, right? Not just clicking.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Do you guys make any? What are your thoughts about the cost of ransom? Of paying a ransom has dropped in a year from $150,000 to $105,000. I kind of zeroed in on that, and I'm wondering, What's the state of ransomware out there? What does that tell us? What do you guys think?
There was another stat that was, I think, in there too, around 64% of victims didn't pay, which is a really fascinating perspective, I thought, too. So,
yeah, I mean, all I would guess is that, you know, there's enough of a universe of victims that they're not willing to negotiate as hard. I mean, the threat actor. That they're like, hey, settle, move on. We got another one to do.
Please pay, maybe.
No, okay, let's go. Yeah, that's fine. Next. Another big thing here that we haven't talked about a lot on the podcast, I think, is there was an uptick in this data set over previous years about very specifically VPN edge devices.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty much attributed to a very small set of 0 days that I guess got really rampantly abused. Mm-hmm. To me, that's kind of good news, though. Like, when you think about attack surface and people are thinking about their own attack surface, and it's just the sprawl is unimaginable, and they're like, oh man, how are we going to get over all this? I think if you hear the message that you got to figure out your remote employee access and work on that, that's digestible.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, whatever your VPN is.
Yeah. So I think in terms of to unpack a couple things that we just talked about. So going back to the ransomware, I think one of the key things that I found, one of the things that I think is driving that drop in the ransomware payments and the cost of the ransomware is just that we are actually starting to focus more on resilience and focusing on recovery over ransom. And I think that's a really, really good trend. When it comes to, let's say, the info stealers or the browser extent, you know, the browser syncing and so on and so forth, there is a greater exposure of credentials across BYOD, and the endpoint hygiene overall is pretty poor on unmanaged systems. But even that is actually starting to improve overall. Like the general hygiene of endpoints are starting to improve because you have more, you know, because Microsoft itself is trying to make the consumer level machines more and more secure and making things like Defender and such, you know, just part of a default setup. I think there's still more ways to go, but I think that is that the notion of, you know, the rising tide lifting all boats really needs to be something that we focus on to address the BYOD issue, the issue of BYOD and info stealers hitting personal machines as well. Because as much as we are caring about the corporate, you know, corporate systems, we also really very much care about our own systems and the ones that our families are using as well. So those absolutely need to be fixed, and I think we should be pushing for that too.
Maybe another, you know, I'm going to be contrarian here. Maybe another way of looking at it is there's more ransomware has become a commodity for attackers. So there's more attackers out there, and there's just less and less victims available. So maybe that's what's driving. I mean, I think we're maybe saying the same thing. There's the victims are less, and there may be maybe more protected, more patched. But then I saw phishing attacks increasing. But regardless, it may be less victims, but a lot more malware attackers, isn't it? Or am I wrong?
You can look at it a slightly different way, that the larger organizations are choosing to be more resilient because they can afford to spend more time and have more willing to have excess, you know, more slack, so to speak, to have the additional resilience. But I think small, medium-sized businesses are still going to be hit disproportionately. And those smaller businesses are not going to be able to, you know, shell out large ransomware payments. So I think part of that is simply that you just have the ransomware actors are hitting the long tail of companies, and that long tail has a just a lower payout, right?
Yeah.
But there's plenty of victims in the SMB market for sure.
Well, you know, another trend might be that just a few years ago, extortion, a larger category. Attacks, I'd say, largely pivoted from true ransomware, which was our computers don't work, to, hey, we've got naked pictures of you. I mean, in other words, we have your Google Drive or whatever, we have data. And maybe that's not worth quite as much. I mean, if your business is completely shut down, you have no choice. If it's, we'll let your customers know that we release your data, it's more of a debate. Like, okay, what's in the data? Is it going to be a big deal? Maybe it's just that drives a lower ransom than system shutdown.
Well, if they had naked pictures of me, I would want to give money to them. To just, you need a therapist, please. I know, I'm sorry. You have to see my pictures. My apologies. Yeah. I feel bad for you.
Yeah, some of these placeholder category names just elicit too many. They trigger too much emotions.
Yeah. You need a therapist. Here, let me give you some money.
Data blackmail. I guess we can't call it naked pictures, but that's right. So one other thing I saw on the report that spoke to on episode 21, we had talked about one-time passwords and about you know, the debate of whether or not we have to burn them down. Google Authenticator, the codes that you could store in iCloud keychain, whether those are too old, you know, old technology, and we have to move to pass to authent yet. And maybe their data set's a little bit old already, and maybe it's a very new thing. But they certainly said that the majority of MFA bypasses, in particular in 360, in Microsoft 365, but I think that's a pretty good place because, you know, the number one, I think, thing on the other side of the link when you get phished is a Microsoft 365 fake login page. And they were saying that token theft was number one, and an adversary in the middle, so like replaying these tokens, was only 9% of those, which was the lowest of the three categories that they tracked. And then later in the report, they go on, when they get into those suggestions, one of the first ones is to use time-based one-time password MFA on your accounts. So that just tells me, like, yeah, maybe we need to worry about the actual technology on the authenticator, and that's good to keep evolving. But what we really need is device-bound tokens. You know, no matter how you get the token, it needs to not work from Uzbekistan, and that needs to be the holy grail. So like context-aware access, right? And the platforms that everybody's using need to adopt that. Yeah.
Yeah, the way I describe it actually is I hate the word context, because the word context, it has no additional context, ironically, right? What exactly do you mean by context? And so what you described, Jerry, just now, is that you want device identity coupled with your, let's say, even application identity or user identity. So this perspective of identity itself is unclear sometimes. We think identity refers to a user, but every asset that we have has its own identity. Think about it. Even a network has an identity, which is like an IP address. Identity's always been the perimeter. The question is, which identities do we want to enable to cross that perimeter? And the perspective here is, the more identities you can strongly bound together, your user identity, your device identity, your application identity, even your network identity, the more that you can bound together, the stronger level of assurance you have that this is truly the right entity. And right now, I think, you know, having device identity coupled with your user identity, right, it is a pretty strong indicator that you're dealing with a legitimate entity. And we're starting to see that more and more when it comes to all the zero trust gateways that we see out there. We just need to have that happen with our application gateways as well, where the applications use that device identity in addition to the user identity.
But I got to hand it to you, Sunil, and just with one word, one statement, you just ruined 10 years of security experience for most of us. Context doesn't mean anything. My God, I've been using that line for what's the context behind this? What's the context behind that? You honestly, I feel I don't drink alcohol, but I should after what you just did.
Yeah. Well, I guess, Sunil, would I be correct to say what you're saying is it takes more than just saying the word. You actually have to supply the context.
That's right. Yes. Okay. It's like, please unpack that for us.
Yeah.
You know, when you say you want more context, that requires more than, you know, just saying the word. Just as much as we see, like, that's actually why I created the cyber defense matrix, because I needed to unpack the word cyber. What do you mean by cyber? Do you mean endpoints? Do you mean network? Do you mean, you know, that was part of the whole genesis of that as well.
Yeah. Next topic that I wanted to jump into here, moving on beyond the Verizon report, but staying pretty close to what we were just talking about, authentication, IDPs, and so on. One thing that can almost become like a corner of this podcast is the bad defaults, right? And I think that's what plagues probably the long tail of companies, is whatever the defaults are, if they're surprising or things people don't realize. We talked about it with BYOD and being able to log into your Okta from your home computer. One of the ones that came up recently, the way this came up, a friend of mine, and I've learned now of yours as well, Sunil, John Lockie, actually, I'll tell you, I don't even think I shared this with you. I was getting him to log into our platform, which is IDP integrated. So it's Google or 365. Most people are Google, and a few 365 accounts, and they all are great. He's having all kinds of problems, and we're troubleshooting it. Long story short, we realize he had, you know, blessed the app and added this one that people are allowed to log in from that tenant, and most of the Google folks don't require that. And it, you know, both of them, the defaults are, as people are navigating the internet, if it says, do you want to log in with, if you pick whatever your IDP is, 365 or Google, you could log in with it. And it just seems like the Google shops have gravitated towards exactly that. And that means anybody could log into anything. And the Microsoft shops have often, and maybe it's just a thing about being an enterprise shop, have gravitated towards default deny. You go to log in with it, says, well, hold on, that's not an approved app, and then your admin has to do it. However, digging into this, so like John was saying is, look, the reason why we do that is I don't care if people log into apps with it. As a matter of fact, we agreed that's actually better because at least now you could have some visibility of what people are logging into. What he didn't want was him logging in and saying, this app can read my email, my inbox. This app can read my whole calendar. This app can read my OneDrive and sync all the data. And the same is true of Google or anything else. Like, how many permissions are you going to have? And so we started digging down this and realized that, like, I think a lot of shops, people can and do, you're right, with the classic fly-by-night GPT email plugin will help you write marketing messages. Can we have access to all of your email? Yeah, of course. And on the other end of the spectrum, Calendly. I want to have access to all your calendar. Of course it does. It's Calendly, and it needs access to it. I feel better about that one. But we're really delegating those decisions down to employees. And I think the consensus thought is that it's just binary. Either you don't allow apps at all, or you allow them and people can do whatever it is that the app wants. First of all, do you think that my reflection on the state of affairs is right, or do you think that people are configuring things differently than that?
So let's actually start with your original premise of the notion of bad defaults, right? So the perspective here is that it's a configuration, and is a configuration good or bad? Well, the answer, of course, is that depends on the parameters of which the organization you're in, the risk tolerance, what you're
context.
Trying to do. I was trying to avoid that word. So let's say what's interesting is that you said in the Microsoft ecosystem, which tends to be full of companies that are more risk adverse, they have a default deny policy on what to allow when it comes to or allowing to use your Microsoft credentials for authentication. So I think that's actually the right view for a risk adverse organization. Those who live in the Google workspace ecosystem tend to be smaller companies, startups. They want to move fast and are more risk accepting of those sort of things. And so for them, you could argue that the right default is actually to allow by default, deny by exception, because being on the administrative end of that, what a pain it is. I've had to deal with this. What a pain it would be to constantly approve things and to make sure that, and people get frustrated because they're like, I can't log into this. I want to try this, and now I've got to wait till some person approves it. So it's a real pain in the butt for those who are just getting started. And I would argue that for those smaller organizations, they have much, much less to lose, right? So if something gets compromised, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, big deal, right? For a large organization, it is a big deal. And so I think it's the right, the question is, what is the right default? And I think depending upon the nature of who you are as an organization, the answer is it depends. And I think the balance that we see here is an interesting macro view of it, but it seems right. Like the Microsoft is going to be more risk averse and the Google world will be more mistaken.
And this is again Sunil doing another one of these. Like, you just make me shake my head inside. My brain is hurting. But this might be a reason. This might be a reason why, even with Google, with all the Google Docs and spreadsheets and all these things they included with their suite, hasn't really penetrated the enterprise business as much as Azure has Microsoft. And I know Microsoft has a foot in the door already with all the years and decades and applications like Office that exist in the business. But is that mentality what Sunil's basically saying? And there's, I think, we used to compete against GCP. And one of the things you knew about GCP, this was at another company I was at, but what you knew about GCP salespeople, they weren't not enterprise salespeople thought. And the application itself is not with that enterprise, that close by default, denied by default So Sunil's right about that. It's interesting because it also permeates that culture at GCP. So again, thank you, Sunil, for highlighting that. You know, I will say, though, that as companies matriculate, they don't necessarily go and move on to Microsoft Office 365. You know, we were born using Google Docs at our company when we were small, but we continue using it. I think it's a really powerful, useful tool, but it is very, it's very open to begin with, and it becomes really difficult to turn things off. That's why I think we both all talked about this, you know, enterprise browsers can be helpful in here because then you start locking down things, you know. And then if you mix the whole bring your own device and you mix all these worlds together, you start noticing a trend here. It's just hard to manage. It's hard to keep an environment secure in these different profiles.
So moving on from the default side of it, like I think your analysis of that is right, Sunil, and it makes sense why the default or the quick click is different in Microsoft versus Google. But what I think is the big problem is that both camps think it's binary, right? And think that you either have to go to the admin to get it, to get log into anything, and then therefore you can log in, you can give it all the access you want, or it's wide open. And I can't tell you that I had studied this, you know, more than a week ago, but after that conversation, I started to study it and went through it and found it in both Google and in Azure. It's completely configurable, and you can let people in either situation, either environment, log into whatever they want, but not grant access to mailbox and calendar. That bounces, and you could actually put a custom error message, tell it to open a Jira ticket or whatever that you want, and then you can have the admins handle it. I think that's the right configuration for most people, probably the desirable one. That said, we're a very small startup. We're Google. We implemented that. All right, boom, let's go. We came to a conclusion at the end of one business day, and we're at least smart enough to say, let's wait till the morning before we do this. So we fire it up. There's no grandfathering. So when you say, hey, the apps, you have to register them, they all get cut off. And wow, I mean, even a small a small environment, the number of apps, and so I'm just talking about apps that need more than login. You can still log in. That didn't cut anybody off. But yes, someone tried to book a meeting with me through Calendly shortly thereafter, and it barfed, right? So I had to go fix that. Fortunately, we figured out where the logs were. You want to do that so you can see the alerts proactively. Mac OS native email client being used for email. I mean, that was cool. I wanted, whoa, let me think about it. Is that okay or not? I hadn't thought about that. The Outlook client on mobile. Yesh ID. Do you know Yesh ID, Dana Wolf? Mm. Awesome. Cool little startup that's like doing basically user provisioning and tracking in the access matrix and all that. We use that to onboard and offboard people. And it started barfing and complaining right away that it's not pulling the directory info. I forgot it even had directory info. But that said, with each of those things, you're able to create a policy and say, okay, for that app, by ID, what are the things that of those that it's normally asked for that you want to allow? And that's what you need to do. It kind of sucks doing it all one morning, especially for a major enterprise. But if you can get ahead of this thing, I think you need to change to that as quickly as possible.
Let me ask a question for both of you, because I went through this, like what you just saying, but with a lot more employees. Now imagine having to do this. And we're not talking about a 1C or 2C by one person. We're talking 10, 20, and multiply that to 4,000, 7,000, 8,000 employees. Now I ask you, Jerry and Sunil, will you do this? Will you do it? Would you recommend? I mean, it's the right thing to do. It's the right thing to start locking these things down. I went through it. It was really awful experience. People were really upset. But would you risk your political capital at a company to do this? Seriously.
Well, like anything, the right way to do it is proactive. You could look at logs in advance and know what people are using and start adjudicating and, oh, we're going to allow this or not. And then you can start building the policy in advance. So, I mean, that's the right way to do it. It's not just to cut it off and see who screams. That's compelling. You don't have to doge it, in other words. Right? I doged it.
Yeah. What I wish, this is definitely wishful thinking, but instead of the notion of secure by default, it's really to actually say, hey, you startup, as you're starting up, let me give you some ways that you can make your future life much easier. Like your future self will thank you by having this sort of control in place right from the very beginning. I wish there was more of that, because unfortunately, it's not saying that's a secure default. It's just could I take a secure path, a path that brings a little bit more control and governance into our world, because we're going to need that a year from now.
Yeah, you know, a lot of you have been in Slacks where every time you use the word standard, it pops in this bot that says, looks like you're proposing this. I hate that so much, the automated replies. So people are allergic to new standards. My initial reaction to what you just said is that people are allergic to landing zones, because that's what that is. That's the everyone has that epiphany at one point of, like, even if this whatever major cloud provider or major email platform, whatever, isn't, it's not worth it for them to do a secure out of the box. If we create that landing zone, right? In AWS, it was the same thing, the AWS landing zone. So everything is pre-configured, and it's going to automate all of that and do it in a much better way, that's a product. And I think a lot of businesses have failed trying to do that for different things. It's an interesting point, though, because what you just said, I hope listeners out there, some of them are like, ooh, that's my next startup, or investors saying, I'm going to find that startup. And it might be the right one, or might be yet another landing zone and fail for the same reasons. I mean, because what I'm hearing out of you is like, oh, you want to be a startup? Pick, you want a 365 or GWS? Here it is configured right.
Actually, it wasn't that as much as to have that more natively within Google itself or within M365.
Natively?
Yeah, I mean, it just makes more sense for them to have that as a core feature.
Yeah, no. I think just given the general, I'm going to put myself in their shoes, in Google's shoes and Azure's shoes. There's just too many different kind of businesses and customers that you have, and different kind of, you know, risk tolerance.
I'll give you an example. This is a really simple example. User number one in your Google workspace. User number one in your Google workspace is almost by definition the admin, right? The super admin that will control everything. Okay. Why not get them onboarded into like MFA and everything right from the very beginning? Okay.
Okay.
But the reason why Google doesn't do this is because people shoot themselves in the foot and they lock themselves out really fast. But if you just created this environment, you can also just blow it away and just start over. Okay. It's much harder to do that, you know, I don't know, a year later. But it's really hard actually to turn on like full MFA for your admins in Google, because Google makes it actually really hard, because so many people have shot themselves in the foot and locked out their entire organization. Like, they cannot get back in, and now Google has to do something. But, you know, what if you just did that from day one? And again, if you make a mistake, no big deal. Just start over. But once you have it in place, you now have a mechanism that allows you to be secure from day one.
So AWS didn't start enforcing MFA for the root user in AWS until recently. And I think we talked about this before. I mean, I know people, security leaderships in AWS that are practically begging leadership to enforce it. And they drag their feet because, I mean, you look at the report, Verizon report, and you see the snowstorm. And they're, you know, so you saw what they talked about, snowstorm.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
You saw that, not enforcing MFA on day one. If somebody locked themselves, the root administrator locked themselves, we had a policy to reset their passwords, but they had to go through an onerous work to get it done. I think things change through time and technology gets accepted more and more. I think using MFA maybe 10 years ago, if you were not PCI in the PCI world, you may have not been using MFA. I think nowadays, most people, even administrators, are going to use MFA on day one. So I think, Sunil, I think your point is right. But I don't know if you could say what you were saying today 5 years ago, 7 years ago. I think people need to go through pain. Before they start accepting this.
Well, it's somewhat, but like, let me put it another way. I'm going to play devil's advocate here. If you could go back in time, and Mara, you don't have to be the one to answer this. If one could go back in time and it force MFA, and I'm not talking about overnight, but do it through a gradual, you know, mature rollout at Snowflake on these accounts, and be guaranteed that if you had done that, you would have avoided this issue and being in the report and all that. I don't even have to work at Snowflake to know that my answer is no. No way. It probably would have hurt uptake and traction. Maybe I'm wrong, but it probably would have. And that is enough, because when I look at the stock price, the downside wasn't that hard. So why risk it?
So at some level, this is a collective action problem too. If we had both M365 and Google require MFA from day one for your admin accounts, you don't have anywhere to go.
Oh, no. So, right. I'm starting a new email platform the day that happens, and it doesn't require MFA. I'm eating their lunch.
And all the, you know, security people out there will be like, don't use that software. Right?
But anyway, I know. But, I'm laughing all the way to the bank.
Yeah, it's a collective action problem that we all have to say, you know what, this is the best course of action for all of us. And to your point earlier, yeah, 5 years ago, it would have been a little harder just because, you know, having hardware, even let alone software tokens, but just having hard tokens, hard tokens are more prevalent now, right? Whether it's built in your computer or you have the external stuff. But the point is that there is now, I don't know about you, but I have like, I don't know, 20 YubiKeys, just like a collection of them, right? So the point is that there's, it's more widely available. And again, whether it's baked into your computer as an external thing. So I think the opportunity for us to say, now's the time to make that mandatory from the very beginning on day one, it's there. So why not take the advantage of the opportunity to do so as a secure default from day one?
Yeah, I think if I move it now to today, I think we're going to find the same problem with AI and new agents and workflows. I think that is an area that we're going to look back 5, 7 years ago, 8 years ago, and we're going to find some similarities. Why didn't we do that? Why didn't we enforce that? You know, I just don't know if we have the ability as people, or even when using machine learning or AI, to be able to forecast certain things happening in the future. You know what I mean? Would you stick your neck out, in other words, today, to set the right framework, even if it meant losing business, Sunil or Jay?
The answer is it depends. And I'll draw a parallel, but it's not exactly the right kind of parallel. So when Oppenheimer and crew were trying to figure out, what do we do with this nuclear weapon that we're about to build? Before it was built, they spent an enormous amount of time thinking through, like, how will this be handled? How will it be translated? All the parameters for how do you ensure that this is going to be secure, right? Don't we wish we could do that for AI? Because AI could become, you know, worse than nuclear weapons. So I think in the context of being very, I really like how Anthropic and to some degree OpenAI and Google DeepMind really was thoughtful about, like, how do we put the right controls in place before we release this to everyone, right? Versus Facebook or DeepSeek saying, hey, everybody can take advantage of this. I think there's going to be a need for thoughtful reflection on how to do this properly. And with AI in particular, we need to do that. Now, what would do that would be, for example, regulation. There's a whole debate about do we disadvantage the U.S. competitiveness in this factor. There's a lot of interesting stakeholders and equities to be addressed to address here. But that said, it is something that I think it needs to be given more thought, and to have the right structures or the right models in place to be able to secure it before we start deploying it more widely.
Well, I think this is how us as leaders in our own space in security, we can also lean in. We should all be saying, we should be supporting the right framework, the right folks who are trying to spouse the right approach to things. Anthropic, I give kudos to those guys and their philosophy and how they want to make sure they, maybe I'm misquoting it, Sunil, but I think Anthropic is trying, even their philosophy about how to be responsible parties using this. And I give them kudos. I've read OpenAI's. It's not as much as what Anthropic is leaning in, right?
Yep. So actually, here's my challenge then to all of us practitioners. The best way to get ahead of it, or to be at least run alongside of it, is to actually start using these AI systems themselves. Get familiar with MCP. Get familiar with A2A. Get familiar with how these large language models work and how they're controlled. Do it even for the sake of making your job easier to do. And what you'll realize along the way is, oh my goodness, there's a whole bunch of holes. And we need to think really quickly about how to design better systems so that they don't have these massive exposures as well. And the only way to do it is to actually just go and do it, you know, learn it yourself. That's how most of us learn security to begin with, right? So yeah. Go try them out.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think you do make pretty good points because we've followed an arc here, right, that started with should you require the best, what's best for security, right? And I threw in revenues is important. That's what I was trying to get at there. And then we went towards AI in particular, and you may be having some existential implications there, so maybe there's more responsibility required around that. I do think that your fiduciary duty is still real too. So even as security practitioners, if we're asking to sacrifice revenue for altruism, sorry, you know, that's not gonna cut it. But I can't help but to think about secure by design, right? Because when CISA really championed that, I paused a little bit because I felt like a lot of normal companies, their top priority didn't need to be secure design. Mm. But their providers did. And I think that's kind of what we're talking about. You were talking about a collective effort at Google and 365 at the same time doing something. I mean, secure by design, yeah, that is incumbent upon AI providers, cloud service providers. So yes, Snowflake, Cloudflare, and so on. But I still don't think that the 99%+ of companies that aren't writing software that the world is relying on, that they need to stop everything and worry about SaaS, you know?
I think you are correct often in that argument, but it only takes is one of these small players, one of these small mom and shops who's building something that the big players are using, and they become the conduit. And this, I've seen it happen enough to say it's real. But I do want to second what Sunil's talking about. Us as our responsibility as security practitioners and leaders, 10 years ago, when it comes to AI, 10 years ago or 7 years ago, I made it I think most of us probably share the same philosophy, but I didn't hire any security people if they didn't know how to code. And now I'm telling for any new security team that I build, if you don't know AI, I'm not going to hire you. And I'm telling that to a lot of my people that I talk and they want to know how to improve their careers. If you don't know if you're not using these tools, like Sunil's saying, it's game over. You're the network engineers, network administrators a decade ago. Where are they now? And you're going to be exactly in the situation if you don't embrace these tools. So lean in, learn, and use your experience to make these things better, more secure. So Sunil, kudos to you. That's a really good, important point.
I think it's a good takeaway for sure. Speaking of that, can you believe we've made it over an hour in and haven't talked about politics in some way? Me neither. I think Success. We all go in not want to talk about it at all, but I bet there's not a podcast out there that's not. Okay, so we got a softball here. Interesting accusation out of China saying that NSA and in particular two named individuals broke in around the Olympics. And that was, I'm sorry, not the Olympics. I forget the games that were hosted in China earlier this year. And so for one, they kind of tit for tat, let's name and shame individuals, which sounds insane to us to imagine happening now that they're, you know, American individuals. But it also makes me wonder, like, it's easy to say, well, this is escalation. They've always known that, and something has prompted them, maybe it's tariffs or whatever, to now call out. What I don't understand, or what I'm not hearing, is the thought that it's that, and that they're just trying to like tit for tat with the name calling, or is it saying that the United States, in particular, is doing different offensive operations in this administration than in the past?
And they added the universities. I hadn't seen that before. Yeah. Right? Well, did you guys catch that?
Yeah. Yeah, so I have a bit more background on some of these things. So let me see if I could put some color. Jerry hit upon it earlier in terms of, we do call out in indictments and such, you know, very specific names of individuals in China. So this is a what about, to me, it was a whataboutism sort of perspective. There are a couple things that make it very clear it's a whataboutism. One is that the fact that they even name names is really unusual because let's just say that the level of abstraction of individuals is not that precise such that you could actually say, oh, it's these people. Okay. So if there was something like that, accusation is actually true, then there's a much bigger issue behind the scenes that has occurred that resulted in a massive spill of some sort. Okay. So let's, the protocols for how things happen is just not the fact that they named people is almost like, really? I don't think that's the case. Second, there's the notion of schools. So, I think that's a farce, but on the China side, it is not, right? There are some very specific universities, SJTU in particular, that we've called out because they definitely are part of the conducting of certain operations. So I just don't see the general counsel of I forget the university. I think it was like Virginia Tech. One's one of them.
It was Berkeley, man. Cal Berkeley, like the most like leftist liberal of the West Coast. Cal, really?
Yeah, that's like, come on, guys. If you're going to accuse the U.S. of these things, at least make it plausible. I feel like it's more of a messaging for the internal audience in China and less for us. And then there's another word here that I just threw me off. Like they call them NSA agents. But I don't know about you, but NSA doesn't have agents. Okay, we don't have agents in the way that the CIA has agents, FBI has agents, NSA. No, that's just. Not that's just the wrong word to use.
It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I mean, if they're I didn't track it down, and the fact that they published names, I thought was pretty interesting, mm-hmm. because it. I mean, I think like journalistically, one could say, well, if we're publishing Chinese names, why aren't we publishing American names? And there's parity here, and it's out there anyway.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, you could say, well, this is the home team, and. You're perpetuating the issue by publishing the names. But one way or the other, if these are real human beings that are now starting to answer questions about this, then someone does know how accurate this stuff is. And I don't expect or want to hear it, but it's out there.
The idea, to me, this is like a sacrificial lamb by the Chinese government. That's what it looks like to me. These folks really are not, these are definitely not the droids to be paying attention to. And they just... The idea that you would name people, it exposes also what you're able to see as a China. Like, so you don't want to let the enemy know what you know as well, right? And so by giving names, you're kind of exposing some potential visibility. Yeah, that's right. So I think these poor folks, really, it was a nothing burger, and it's just for sacrificial lambs. And I think they just did it on this whole tariff situation that's going the tariffs that are going on right now. It's strictly political. There's nothing here.
Yeah. So do either of you feel like the targeting operations might be, I mean, because remember we had talked about it before with the idea that it's a little bit different because of the Chinese walls, if you don't mind me saying, between business and government, and the fact that if the U.S. government and offensive operations assisted one industry, then you could get into some antitrust problems and why aren't you helping me and all that. Maybe nobody cares. Maybe who cares about the law? I mean, do you think maybe something different is happening as of January that we're conducting ourselves differently in offensive operations?
I don't know of any GC that would sign up for that. All I would see is just liability after liability after liability. I just don't see any corporate lawyer signing off on that.
Hmm. Okay. You don't see any patterns on it? You don't think Deal, the lawyers from Deal would have... signed off on this one, and
Well, that's definitely an outlier for sure. I hope so. It's an outlier, but yeah.
All right. Well, great. This is fun. Safe travels, Sunil and Mario. Same thing on your bicycle on Tuesday morning. And I'm looking forward to seeing you guys in person. And for the listeners, yeah, pop up and tell us hello and offer us some feedback and what our topic is going to be next time. See you guys soon.
Thanks.